So, are you having a good cruise or what?
No. It's sad. Everyone here is sad.
Yeah, but that's everywhere, isn't it? I mean, at least here, they can give you all you can eat shrimp.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 286 for the week of January 20, 2020. I am head cookie David T. Cole, and I'm here with activist speller Sarah G. Bunting.
H-I, hi.
Squash Jaguar Tara Ariano. And Nigerian cowboy Alan Sepinwall.
I have a lot of thoughts about hamburgers.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great. Returning is our friend, Rolling Stone's chief TV critic, Alan Sepinwall. Hello, Alan.
Hello.
Hey, guys.
Yay! Alan's back to join us in talking about Little America, which he reviewed a couple of weeks ago. We'll link it in the show notes. Little America is the newest show from Apple TV Plus. It comes from Emily V. Gordon, Kumail Nanjiani, and Alan Yang, among others. And it's an anthology show that tells different stories about immigrants that are basically TV-ized from their format where they originally appeared in Epic magazine. Generally positive little half-hour stories of people that came to America and how that happened in their various lives. So this is the first, I would say, big anthology series to come to our screens since Amazon's Modern Love, and has a lot in common with it, at least on paper. Both are based on print series of real people's mini memoirs, both 8-episode seasons of roughly half-hour episodes. And Alan, I went back and reread your Modern Love review because I remembered you being more generous to it than a lot of other critics, including me. But you were certainly much more effusive in your review of Little America, which, as I said, we'll link to. So why do you think Little America works better than Modern Love?
It's a wonderful show. It's the first really genuinely good, great Apple TV show. It's the first one where I haven't had to squint and say, oh, well, I guess I can kind of see some positive things. I think a lot of it is it has a specific perspective and a take and an idea, which is here are these immigrant stories. They're all rooted in reality, which is, as you say, Modern Love was. But I just think this does it better. And I think the stakes involved, you know, whether there's a really, you know, small story like this French woman going to, you know, a new age retreat in the 70s, or to a really much bigger stake story like the kid in the first episode whose parents get deported and he tries to, you know, make it to the finals of the National Spelling Bee so that he can ask Laura Bush to help them get back. There's more weight to everything they do, and I think the stories are really well told, and they do a lot of smart choices in terms of how big or small they let each story be and the tone of them, and I had to have tissues out quite a lot throughout this, and particularly for the first 3 or 4 episodes.
I agree. One of the things that I think makes the difference is that there's care taken with the casting, which is to say, it's not, unlike Modern Love, it's not a vehicle for big American stars. And since this is something that Sarah usually calls out in a when it's done in a good way, I want to throw that to you. How did the casting strike you, Sarah?
I thought it was great. I thought that these, you know, this is real America, and these look like real people. Sherilyn Fenn as Laura Bush. I just had to sit quietly for a minute in my office. Like, once the credits came up, I just had to pause and be like, A, I was right, which who doesn't enjoy that? And B, mm-hmm. Wow, like what a Moebius of reference that is. Mm-hmm. But I thought the casting was good. I thought that it had a real ear for pulling back from its own tropes just in time, or finding ways to invert them. Like in the second episode, the Squash Jaguar episode, which mm-hmm. I loved, and I love her coach and he is hilarious. Like, it's so many good lines, but then she's listening to all this old schmaltzy like montage music because her iPod came from wherever it came from. Salvation Army.
From Goodwill.
And yeah, she'd wipe it. So like, I thought that that was really like, they wanted to use Bruce Hornsby and they found a way to do it and not make it ridiculous. Bruce Hornsby is ridiculous. How do you do that?
Brings us to possibly the most important question of this episode, which is, can Mandolin Rain qualify as an awesome jam?
I mean, we differed in our room. I was like, it is an awesome jam. I mean, is it a jam? Maybe not. Is it an awesome song? Yes. I loved hearing it.
I also loved hearing it. Jam? I don't know. Like, there's a piano. There's limits to how far that can go. But, like, now it's an awesome jam because it's associated with this story. And I also thought that it was good at being emotional without being sentimental. And heartwarming without being Hallmarky and cheesy. It wasn't cheaply done. It wasn't cheaply had. So yeah. I really liked it.
Yeah. I mean, for me and probably for Dave and Sarah, I think we emotionally needed this show to recover from the first two episodes of Party of Five, which we talked about last week. Because some of these stories, of course, also have heartbreaking elements. And because immigration remains an issue that this country has not figured out yet, even episodes that are set in the past echo our current moment. But this definitely is a very pro-immigrating to America show overall, I would say.
It's very, I really needed something like this. Absolutely, even not having seen Party of Five. But it also, it's... A lot of the episodes are sad to begin with, but they feel kind of extra sad because it feels like some of these stories just couldn't happen now. Like, one of the last ones involves a gay man from Syria who has to come here just basically to stay alive. And, you know, in the time between when the episode was made and now, our immigration stance towards Syrian refugees has changed quite a bit. So that's tough. But I think that they really do capture... a wide range of emotions and tones, and the casting is really good, and most of the people are unknowns, and every now and then you get somebody more notable like Zachary Quinto, or Sarah, you mentioned the squash coach, that's John Ortiz, who I always love in everything, and he got to be really funny in this, so they really nailed a lot of the little details throughout it.
Yeah, I felt like the tone kind of felt like a slightly political 2020 in tone version of something you would find about immigration, say in Schoolhouse Rock, which is you can do good if you come to America and apply yourself, the land of opportunity, but let's fast forward 40 years and color that a little bit with what's actually going on. They don't get too political,
right?
You know, putting the hammer right on the nail in Party of Five. But this one, they are celebrating immigrants and showing some of the shit they have to go through or can't go through.
Right.
Which makes it much sadder in a way without being that much more direct. It's not a sad show. It is sad at times, very hopeful at times. It made me really appreciate how few quality anthology shows we got going on right now. And it's kind of making me excited to see Amazing Stories, just to have like another anthology show where you just get something new each time. Like, I understand the, you know, the scale of economy for an anthology show cannot be good. So you really have to have somebody that is just farting money into a toilet to make them like everything that's happening on streaming right now, because each one of these episodes, different location, different cast, different everything, you know, different, everything's, you know, a self-contained ecosystem almost.
And right.
I assume same with Amazing Stories, which is debuting soon, but it's just really nice to have a bunch of tales that do not have to be connected, but are still part of a narrative flow. And it's just nice to have on TV. I wish we had more.
Yeah.
And God bless them for being a half hour each, because, man, there's so many ways in which this could have been bloated and too long, and every episode felt just about right.
Yeah, that's true. Was anyone else reminded of High Maintenance a little bit by this show? By like the slices of the lives that you get and how, like, where they choose to bring you in and where they choose to take you out. Like, I'm thinking the first episode and sort of that line the mom has at the end where she's like, how's your life? Do you have a good life? And there's so many sort of ways in and out of that question for the character and for the viewer. And it was this really lovely and quite sad moment, I thought. They're all sort of watching TV together, but there's this big space still, this big distance between them. And it did remind me a little bit of High Maintenance in that that is kind of an anthology, but there's, you know, the guy who ties it all together. But it reminded me of that in its essential, I would say, sweetness and its love for its characters. So,
yeah. Has the same warm-heartedness.
But also it finds those moments in small ways, like the celebration day for them, for the Indian family who comes back. Indian? Pakistan?
Yeah, they're Indian.
Indian. That come back is dinner at KFC and TV at night. Like that is like, it's, you know, kind of quintessentially pop culture American. But like High Maintenance, it finds the sweetness in these small moments.
Yes. Yeah, it doesn't have an attitude about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of food, there is one issue that really struck a personal chord with Dave, and it came in episode 5 about Beatrice from Uganda. And it tortured him for the rest of that night and into the next day after we watched the episode.
So I don't want to get too far into how David Cole is trying to lose weight, but basically he's really good on the weekdays, and Saturday he kind of just blows it out a little bit and he treats himself to whatever. Kind of a cheat day, I guess, you know, the system. And when we go shopping on Friday night for weekend supplies, I always seem to forget that David T. Cole likes bakery items when he's at the store. Like nothing seems appealing on Friday night, but when it comes Saturday, I always want cookies and like carrot cake and stuff like that. And damn, those chocolate chip cookies she
they
was making.
So good.
They were like extra thick, you know, like you could tell around the edges, it would be nice and crisp just the way Dave T. Cole likes them. But in the middle, they're a little bit soft. They remind me of the cookies. I used to be my job in high school was donut baker. I would work like 10 o'clock at night to 2 o'clock in the morning baking the donuts for the next day. And cookies were a part of that. And I always made the cookies extra big so that they would be kind of almost raw in the middle.
Mm-hmm, that's how they made them at our high school cafeteria, too.
And it kind of reminded me of those. I'm sure they weren't raw in the middle, but man, did I ever have like that craving from like the sensory overload from just seeing that cookie and my stomach for seriously the next 4 hours. I was just talking about those cookies. Stupid little American.
I mean, she fit in, you know?
Yeah.
Immigrant to immigrant, she spoke to you.
Yeah, the way to Americans' hearts is definitely through their stomachs, for sure.
But did you resonate with the hamburger rant, though?
No, not really. I mean, I understand it, you know, that if you take care cooking the prime ingredient, you know, whether that be beef or whatever, and then you just hide it in 10,000 other things.
Sure.
I get it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's also like, here's an example. I remember me and my dad used to go to Lung Yu on Lundy's Lane, Highway 20 in Niagara Falls. It was like this truck stop Chinese place that my dad used to go at all the time because he was basically like equivalent to highway patrol. Mm-hmm. And I always remember this one day I went there and got like some combo special, and it was like, you know, eating this thing with a spoonful of the other thing that was on the plate, whatever it was, a chicken ball and like broccoli stuff or whatever.
Sure.
Thinking to myself, should I be doing this? Like if they're at the same table, would they be like, ooh, gross, you're eating those two things on the same forkful?
Right.
Across the room, they had just come back from Burger King and they were putting French fries in their burgers and eating them. So I thought, all right, we're all the same. It doesn't really matter. You like it, you like it.
It's a beautiful story, Dave.
Thank you.
What a country.
Segue from that too. When Trump initially enacted the Muslim ban in 2017, there was a tweet that was going around that was something to the effect of, I know of a guy who came to this country as a Syrian refugee and then his son founded Apple Computers, which I think the point was supposed to be that everyone deserves an opportunity to fulfill their potential and not that any refugee could end up having economic value to the country they moved to. But is a possible knock on this show that it foregrounds model minorities, which is to say, does season 2 need to have at least one episode about an immigrant who's like a real piece of shit? And if so, I volunteer. Alan, your thoughts? Or just a dirtbag, you know?
I mean, I don't think that they're model minorities. I think they do a nice job of saying, like, some of these are good kids and some of them are not. I mean, the French woman in the silent retreat isn't necessarily, like, the greatest person in the world, even though she hooks up with the hot guy from the Coen Brothers Western. But I think it's just like these little stories. And even the spelling kid, like he winds up screwing up his life a fair amount once it becomes clear his family isn't coming back anytime soon. So I think like as long as it humanizes them, whether they're good or bad, that's okay.
Yeah. And speaking about that first family who owns the motel, you know, they're not 100% good people because they're playing cricket in their own parking lot. And I'm saying, if I'm staying at your motel, I don't want a cricket match happening in the parking lot. First of all, you're going to hit a car. But second of all, it's just noisy and inconsiderate. Go to the park. So I'm just saying we're not all model citizens 100% of the time.
Also, they left him with this guy who's not even his uncle. One of my favorite scenes was him asking the kid for a light. And he's like, I'm 12. And he's like, I didn't ask for your whole life story. So
that was good.
Yeah. I mean, he's not a model citizen, but perhaps he was born in Utah.
Also, the way they sort of mix it up a little bit is some of the stories are about immigrants in America, and some of the stories are about immigrants mostly before they come to America.
Right.
Like the Grand Expo winner episode was really more about what happened before she came to America.
Right.
That she was a victim of the one-child policy. So it's not all rah-rah America, land of opportunity. It just is like, well, people have to put up some shit sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, like, and these are the people that are here now, and they are made of tough stuff, you know, like that's the story of some of them. So it's not like I would never call this show jingoistic, but it's like even where it's celebrating what America offers immigrants, it's even hedging its bets there a little bit, not telling that story over and over again, which I appreciate.
Fair. So the creative team was at the TCA press tour on the weekend and, quoting Deadline, collectively said that the series will not deal with politics in an overt way. However, they noted that any program that examines the humanity of immigrants sends a political message, which, Alan, is a point that you also made in your review, and I agree. And when we came to the point in the first episode, for example, when Laura Bush makes it clear she's not going to intervene in Kabir's parents' asylum case, I was like, well, this is where the conservatives tap out, but then realized, oh, conservatives probably aren't watching this show.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, it's definitely a preaching to the converted kind of show, but that's basically all of entertainment and culture at this point in our sad society, I think.
Yeah, I think they got at it in around the edges too, like Marisol's nihilism in the second episode, where she sort of was like, nothing I do in high school matters because I can't go to college, you know, where it's like, because she's undocumented. And, you know, but also at the same time, I love how even some of the Americans that they run, that the various characters that we meet run into are kind of dickish, but there aren't really any villains per se. Even in the third episode with Tom McCarthy as the shitty professor at the school in Oklahoma, he's just like,
he's
kind of,
so
kind of a rag.
He's so good at being shitty.
Yeah, he's,
he really is.
But he's not a villain. Like, he turns out to be a decent person. And again, like, you know, like I said last week, I consider this positive propaganda and I'd approve, but, you know, it's like no one is a villain here except policy, which is the case probably in most people's situation, I think.
Yeah, when McCarthy gives the guy his first paycheck and says, like, spend it on something personal, and we cut to him, like, standing next to the motorcycle he got to honor his dad, that's when I started bawling. And that episode was my favorite. Man.
God.
How about we end it off with favorite episodes? So if somebody hasn't watched and they just want to check out one episode to figure it out, why don't we go around the room? So sure. Alan, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I would say number three, The Cowboy, is by far my favorite.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Marisol the Squash Jaguar. That was the second episode. She was my favorite. And like Sarah, I also loved John Ortiz in that episode as her coach.
Sarah. Yeah, Squash Jaguar.
Well, I'm going to agree with Alan. Cowboy was my favorite.
That was good too.
And part of that TCA interview was that they are considering going further back in time than they had in season one.
Yeah.
And that was my favorite. I kind of feel like the further they go back in time, the more just like anthropologically interesting it was for me. So I would love to see them go super back in time and basically like follow Bill the Butcher sort of guy come into the country and like what that means to be in an America that is more lawless and, you know, have what the immigration stories are then would be super interesting. And I think they would definitely go there. Like, perhaps not that scenario, but I think the show has enough room that they can do almost anything.
Yeah. I mean, when we lived in New York, we went on a tour of the Tenement Museum and that was fascinating. Like you have to think there are like tens of thousands of hundreds of thousands of stories just in that those four blocks alone.
Incredibly well documented.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they could totally do that. Yeah. Good point. It is time to go around the dial talking about things we're watching on TV lately. Tara Ariano, you're up first.
Well, Dave has zero, so I'm going to do two, one more than the other. First, Avenue 5. So this is the new Armando Iannucci show on HBO. And when the premise was announced, I was like, ooh, I don't know about this one. And then we watched the pilot, and I was like, ooh, I was right to be concerned. So this is... Armando Iannucci, of course, is the creator of The Thick of It and Veep and many other shows in Britain. Anything with Alan Partridge attached, pretty much, he had a hand in it. So here, Hugh Laurie is the captain of a futuristic space-like cruise ship.
Right.
And in their, I don't know if it's the maiden voyage, unclear, it doesn't matter. Something bad happens and they go off course in the first episode and everyone panics. And you're hopeful that things are going to be good because a lot of people are in it that have been in previous Iannucci projects, like Rebecca Front from The Thick of It and Zach Woods, from who was also in The Loop, and Hugh Laurie, of course, who was on Veep in a recurring role. And then that first episode is so bad. As we were watching it, Dave was like, are they writing it as they go? Like, it just is so inert. And when I was complaining about it, or actually, Karen Geyer, past guest of the show, was complaining about it on Twitter yesterday. And I agreed with her that it was very bad. And she said, how many episodes of The Thick of It could they have made for the price of this pilot? And it's true. It's like, 1,000? Like, it looks so expensive. And it's like... what a waste. And then I read Alan's review and he was like, well, the fourth episode that gave critics is the best one.
Oh, no.
Alan, your thoughts?
Nobody got
defend
time for
your
that.
Opinion.
I did not really like the pilot either. And I was very disappointed given, you know, how much I love Veep and The Thick of It and The Loop and all of that. Mm-hmm. The show, at least at the start, is kind of a mess. There's a lot of Josh Gad, and Josh Gad is like, needs to be a garnish and not a main dish, and he
yeah.
he is here. Then, like, later on, it does start to improve, but it really, even the fourth episode, which I thought was the best, I still wouldn't necessarily say that it was a good show. It was just much improved over what it had been, because
right.
as you go along, you start discovering that a lot of what you think is happening on this ship is not quite what's actually happening, and they develop some comedy out of that, but they dig themselves a really big hole on the way there, and I don't know if they're going to be able to dig themselves out by the end of the season.
Ugh. Yeah, we will not be around to find out.
So. Well, the Fair. Miracle of the internet is somebody tells me it became the most amazing thing in season two. There is nothing stopping me from checking it out, but it just, inert is the perfect word for how I felt that show was.
I mean, it just felt it was so draggy. Like, yeah. It was only a half an hour. And it was like, oh, this felt like
Alan
it was
nailed
forever.
It. Josh Gad is the banana in the smoothie of the show, for sure. Yeah.
Yes. So I will talk more at length about 911 Lone Star. So 911 is the procedural show on Fox. It's now in its third season, where all kinds of crazy shit is happening all the time. And it's the show where every time I read about it, I'm like, why am I not watching this show? Because every episode, it seems like, or perhaps only the ones that people write about, are the ones where the craziest shit you could possibly imagine occurs. Like, a bouncy house blows away with kids in it. Or
really? Awesome.
I believe that's right.
That's
or
great.
Most famously.
That did happen.
Thank awesome. You, Alan. In the first episode, someone has a baby and flushes it down a toilet.
Sure.
And the baby lives and they extract her from the pipe.
Oh, I think the baby lives and becomes Fluke Man from The X-Files.
Oh, hello.
It's an exciting crossover. So then they announced they were going to do 911 Lone Star, and it was going to be set in Austin. I was like, yes, here's my entry point. And I was so excited for all of the Austin emergencies that they could come up with.
Yeah.
So the pilot, it premiered on Sunday night. It was they called it a two-part pilot, which it's not really. It was like a pilot on Sunday night, and then they had another episode in its regular time slot the following night, which fine. So the premise is Rob Lowe plays Owen Strand.
Yeah.
He's a cop. Sorry, he's a firefighter.
Boy, that went through the white guy name generator.
No kidding.
Wow.
He's a firefighter in New York. He was a firefighter in New York on September 11th, 2001. So he had to rebuild basically his whole ladder company from the ground up because a bunch of them died. And
he sells ladders?
Wah. So Kyle Secor is the fire chief of Austin, and he comes to town. to try and hire Rob Lowe away because they also just had their whole ladder company die in a catastrophe that starts because someone put a burrito in tinfoil in a microwave and started a fire. That's the first thing that happens in the pilot. At a manure factory. So Rob Lowe's like, no, thank you.
Wait,
and
hang
then
on. Where?
A manure factory.
That's bullshit.
Yeah. So Rob Lowe's son, who's also a firefighter who works with him, proposes to his boyfriend and gets rejected. And so and then he overdoses on pills. He has an existing addiction problem. And Rob Lowe decides, we're going to both move to Austin and start over. So they do. And they, there's, of course, because they're from New York, they have to have a whole thing about, I can't believe how cheap real estate is here. And they look at a house and they're like, it's $4,500. Like, A, where? B, is it a 10-bedroom house? Because that price is insane. But anyway, the other thing is that they have to, the department is under like some kind of Department of Justice mandate because they've had diversity problems. So they're hiring people based off like viral firefighter rescue videos. So they bring in like a Muslim woman from Miami and this trans guy from Chicago. And
we call this one TikTok.
Basically. And then there's a whole scene that like one of the things that was most reported on, because it's fucking absurd, is like a multiple minute scene in this beautiful, they also redo the firehouse, like it's completely West Elm from top to bottom. And the locker room at the firehouse is like nicer than spas I've been in, and I have been in some spas. But they have a multiple minute conversation about skincare, where Rob Lowe, like his character, gives like a lecture about all of the stages of skincare, which his routine, by the way, has more steps in it than mine does, which fine, like his vanity is a character note and it should be. He is much more beautiful than I am.
I was going to say, do you think Rob Lowe sort of like wrote the script at that point?
They wrote that as a character note into his thing, but at least he is not selling Rob Lowe skincare, which he has his own skincare line.
Of course, sure.
But then like so that's all fine. But the actual emergencies are really not Austin-y at all. Starting with the burrito, which Dave pointed out, like shouldn't be a burrito, should be a taco. Yeah. A. Mm-hmm.
That's a San Francisco emergency.
That's what I put in my post for Farm Timer. There's a car accident where a baby gets like flung out of its car seat or flung out of the van in its car seat, still in a tree.
But then bats don't pick it up, I assume.
And bats don't pick it up. Exactly, Sarah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So yeah, like it's just not, so far it's not Austin-y enough. And that might be partly a function of, like, clearly at least the first episode, possibly the first two, are clearly shot in Los Angeles.
Right.
Like, it does not look like Austin at all. So maybe like the real, you know.
I would also bet dollars to donuts the fact that it was based in Austin was a relatively late decision, just based on our time in Bravo and
perhaps
the whole Top Chef thing where they're like, what?
Yeah, you know, Fox network needs more viewers in Texas.
Yeah, right, exactly. And then they're like, all right, well, then it's Top Chef Houston. Here we go.
Sure.
That was an actual thing.
I know.
So, you know, I would bet that this could have been 911 Nashville until probably a few months before they actually.
Right. That's a great point. Anyway, it's fine. I'm going to continue watching it to see if they like crank up the Austinicity of it. But you can see the alternate Austin emergencies that I propose that I think would be better in a post that I wrote about it for Primetimer. So
it's one of them vigilante justice for Alamo talkers. The manager won't do anything. The server won't do anything. So I have to take the law into my own hands.
That's not even that local anymore because there's Alamos everywhere. But yes,
yeah, that's true.
Good point. Yeah. So I have a post about that on Primetimer and also off Medical Police. I mentioned this last week, but now it is actually up. If you watched Medical Police on Netflix and you want to know what other shows can I watch that are spoofs of other TV shows, you can go to my list of 13 other TV show spoofs, including Look Around You, Eagle Heart, obviously Children's Hospital, many more. Primetimer.com. We'll link them in the show notes.
Mr. Alan Sepinwall.
So Sex Education came back on Friday for a second season. I really liked that show in its first year. It was one of my favorites of 2019. There's still a lot I liked about this season, but I got really frustrated through large chunks of it because it feels like they decided in year two that the most important part of the show isn't here's a bunch of kids, you know, running a sex clinic at the school and dispensing sex advice and trying to sort of like help their classmates through problems. No, the franchise is here's a bunch of horny kids and a bunch of love triangles and let's manipulate them around and try to change things up here and there. And so like half of the season is just them recycling old Ross Rachel moves from Friends, like, you know, just different stupid things that happen to try to keep the central couple from getting together or put different people into different combinations. And I just, like, there are things that this show does that no other show does, and they seem to be running away from that and trying to make it more like lots of other things. And it's a real bummer because I like all these actors, and there's so many moments that are good that they just, then they go down this stupid hole. And the season ends with something involving a voicemail that, you know, as soon as it's sent, the other person isn't going to hear. Spoiler. And I just groaned, and it makes me much less enthusiastic for whenever it's going to come back for season three, which I always hate because, like, I like the show a lot.
Going down a stupid hole is probably something that happens in season two that frustrated you. It's a sex joke.
Yes, yes, yes.
Thank you.
And what do you have to plug there, Mr. Rolling Stone chief TV critic?
Well, for my plug, I've written quite a bit about Little America, both the review and the show notes. I published an interview today with the other showrunner, Lee Eisenberg, whom you might know from such Office episodes that I will never watch again as Dinner Party and Scott's Tots. So sure. There you go.
One very good cringe, one very bad cringe.
Yep.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Making it a hat trick for references to Alan's reviews. I tried the pilot of Awkwafina is Nora from Queens. I read Alan's review. I feel like the thrust of it, and Alan, you can obviously correct me if I'm getting this wrong, is that it is unclear, based on this show at least, and possibly generally, whether Awkwafina works better on her own or needs to be in tandem with other people. Ellen also got all the screeners, and I got one, and the one I got was the pilot, and it is not good, and it's, like, not even not good in particularly pilot-y ways. It's just, I mean, the word inert came up about Avenue 5, and also the idea that they're writing it as they go along. Both of these, I thought, could apply to this. I don't think I'm going to keep going. It's a fine line between sort of loosey-goosey and a mess and disorganized, and this is well over that line, unfortunately. I love Awkwafina. I love BD Wong. He is doing some interesting things. Like, there's one scene where he's just sitting there with his eyes closed. He's, like, not doing anything. He's not doing any sitcom-y business. He's not watching TV. That's kind of unusual. I think the point of that scene and him in it is that everything in it is covered in plastic, including the TV remote, but his choice to just not be doing anything in that is interesting. But between the grandma being a variation on the tired, horny grandma trope, and the fact that I don't think Awkwafina's best friend in this would even know her, and there's a whole cab driver sequence that is, like, not grounded in any reality, and it's so slow. Like, it just should be much funnier and much faster. And the worst part is she does not seem confident. Like, physically, she seems sort of small and like she's turning to the side a lot as the lead of the sitcom. I did wonder going into it if the reason we wanted more of her in stuff like Crazy Rich Asians and Ocean's 8 isn't that she is one of those performers who is best, not even as a garnish, but, like, I don't know, the starch and not the protein. That metaphor is not going to work. Maybe she's just not cut out. Maybe the pilot is just not good. Alan, should I bother sticking around?
I mean, I definitely laughed more at other episodes than at the pilot, and there's a couple that I thought were actually good episodes. But, like, the whole season basically feels like they're figuring out what the show is, and I'm not sure they quite got there by the end. So, in this case, Sarah, I would suggest probably wait until season two comes out, see what I and other people might have to say, and you can reconsider it then.
Okay, because it did get a season two, which is great. Good for her. I want good things to happen to her, but this is to date. Not one of them. It's premiering as you are listening to this tonight, but I can't recommend it.
The fact that they didn't have the confidence in it to just call it Nora from Queens and had to call it Awkwafina is Nora from Queens, like, whoa, calm down.
What,
like,
kind of nobody got beats it. The Wiz titling bullshit is that? Like, that's not going to work. It's really a mouthful.
Excellent.
So, yeah, I'm going to wait for season two. Good tip, Alan. And thank you for that and your review, which will also be in the show notes, along with, I think, everything else you've written in the last week and a half. Yay!
I'm busy.
For my plug, I will be mounting a spirited defense of Friday Night Lights' second season for Primetimer.com. Just kidding.
Yay.
I will not be doing that. I will, however, be talking about how to counter program the Super Bowl with other football TV shows, including four seasons of Friday Night Lights, QB1, and a bunch of other stuff that will be on primetimer.com later this week. Look out for it.
Now that music means it is time for the canon. Rolling Stone TV editor-in-chief Grand Poobah of Rolling Stone is submitting this week. Take it away, Alan.
All right. So when you spend as much time as I do watching and writing about TV shows where the main characters do monstrous things on the regular, it can get kind of numbing. I've literally written books about The Sopranos and Breaking Bad, and I still love those shows. But there are definitely days when I watch some news series about a charismatic asshole, or at least one who occasionally feels bad about being an asshole, and I start to wish I was instead watching something about a nice couple who runs an animal rescue. So why, you may ask, am I here to talk about an episode of The Americans, a show that constantly asks viewers to sympathize with a pair of KGB spies who are constantly murdering innocent people in pursuit of the Soviet agenda? And why, particularly, am I here to talk about an episode like Season 2's Marshall Eagle, which is explicitly about how sad one of the two feels about all these awful things he has to do? Because when the execution is this spectacular, I'll forgive a lot of collateral damage, you know? The Americans was a very good show in its first season, but it really leveled up in year two by focusing more on the emotional cost of the job to the Jenningses, and particularly to Philip, as played so well by Matthew Reese, whom my old buddy Brian Grubb likes to describe as handsome Eeyore. Marshall Eagle comes relatively late in that season, after Philip has had to kill a lot of people who didn't much deserve it, and after he and Elizabeth have been feeling the squeeze from all sides. Another family of deep cover operatives got murdered for reasons unknown. Their daughter Paige is getting involved at the local church, which is horrifying to her godless communist parents. They're juggling multiple fake relationships, including Philip getting married to poor Martha, secretary to FBI Special Agent Gadd. It is a lot to deal with, and we shouldn't feel much or any sympathy for these two, except for the performances by Reese and Kerry Russell, and how smartly the show is written and directed. Marshall Eagle opens with the two of them breaking into a military base where the Contra freedom fighters from Nicaragua are being trained to fight the communist-backed Sandinistas. It's a sequence that features one of the more ridiculous spy disguises the show ever used, as we're expected to believe that Kerry Russell can pass for a man. But pretty soon the body count is so high that there's nothing really to laugh about. Even the driver that Philip thought he left tied up safely in the woods dies of exposure, and Reese plays the whole thing in a way that makes clear just how much Philip hates himself for every last little bit of it. It's a Paige-centric episode, and while I ordinarily roll my eyes up to the heavens whenever a prestige cable or streaming drama tries to spend time in the main character's terrible teenage children, I love what the Americans started doing around this point with Paige. First of all, she's not terrible. She's just a nice kid, oblivious to who her parents really are, feeling understandably adrift because of all the lies they're keeping from her, and in search of a place to belong and do something good. So she starts hanging out with Pastor Tim and the other people at the church, not realizing that her actions are an existential threat to what her parents do and believe. And that leads us to our first clip.
They're feeding refugees, building houses. You guys don't help anyone.
We help you. We help you, and we helped you save that money. Please, do not roll your eyes at me. You can show me some respect.
Paige, you started lying to us?
I didn't lie.
Well, you certainly don't seem to know the difference.
Do you? Stop
Why
it!
Does this book tell you to do that?
Philip.
Does it? You respect Jesus, but not us!
Whenever I think about the fact that it took until the show's final season for Reese to win an Emmy, and that Russell never won one, that's how angry I get. Now, plot was never the show's strongest suit, and Marshall Legal landed around the same point in each season where I would lose the thread on at least half of the operations Philip and Elizabeth were running. But it never mattered much, because the creative team very smartly used the spy missions as a way to amplify a personal problem for one or both of our leads. This episode has a couple of great examples of this. The first is when Elizabeth seems to be spilling her guts to a friend she met in AA, when in fact she's getting close to the woman to aid her in getting access to American defense secrets. But the way Kerry Russell plays it, you can tell that on some level it's helpful to Elizabeth to be able to vent in a way that can never be traced back to her real life. The second involves Martha, for whom Philip plays a doctored recording from the FBI office, which we can hear in our second clip.
But I love the way you look. I love every part of you, and if I could, I would go in there and I would...
I know you would, Clark.
But I have a job.
A very important job.
And things are a lot worse than you know.
What?
Have you ever heard of stealth?
No.
It's a huge, complex military project. I don't understand it all, but there are a lot of leaks coming out. We think of your office. We found it very difficult to find a source.
What do you need?
Like the Elizabeth scene, it plays on multiple levels. Philip is drawing Martha in tighter, but he's also so angry with himself that he's looking to hurt others, whether it's Agent Gadd or even poor Martha herself, who made the mistake of falling in love with a monster in a blonde wig. The more Philip does, the more he hates himself, and the more he needs a target for that hatred that allows him to stay on mission. This winds up being Pastor Tim, who's doing some late-night work at the church when Paige's crazy father comes in to confront him, which we hear a little of in our final clip.
Are you really gonna beat me up, Mr. Jennings? For $600? For your daughter?
I would do anything for my daughter. I would do anything for my daughter.
The best thing you can do for her is find a way to deal with your anger.
I'm not here to be saved. Not by you, Tim, or your God.
I see that you're in pain, Mr. Jennings. There is grace and forgiveness for you. For everyone.
Do you believe that?
I do.
The fight with Paige is the more explosive one, but I love this scene because of how utterly broken Philip is in it. He clearly has no plan at the church. Actually, killing Tim would create big problems, as the show touches on in later seasons, and even beating him up would draw more attention than a deep cover spy needs. He's there because he has nowhere else to go and no idea what to do. And for a hot second, Tim's talk of grace and forgiveness starts to sound good to him. The problem is he's utterly committed to the path he and his fake wife started down when they were teenagers. He's long since damned, and while I shouldn't exactly feel sorry for him, Reese gets me way closer than I have any business being. For the most part, Americans is one of those shows where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and I tend to think about seasons and story arcs more than individual episodes. But I knew Marshall Eagle was on another level the night I first saw it, and I hope you'll give it a place in the canon.
Thank you, Alan. I have pondered an Americans rewatch so that I could do a canon submission, so thank you for doing this before I embarked upon that project. I still may, but now I don't have to do it right away. I this episode was great, and you didn't touch on this in your rundown, but one of the other plot threads is that Stan, because of the stealth leaks, is interviewing people that have security clearance to talk and getting them to talk about, basically interviewing them to find out what secrets they may have that they could be exploited over. Because that's what spies do. And, you know, of course, we know that's what Philip and Elizabeth do. But they also exploit people about their beliefs. And that's why I think they're so paranoid about Paige's growing relationship with Pastor Groovy Hair, because that's another way that they weaponize belief against their marks. They do it with Fred, the John Carroll Lynch character in this episode, who's disillusioned with his idea of America. Elizabeth is getting ready to turn her marks belief in AA against her. We also see Sandra, just as a side note, getting ready to leave Stan for someone who shares her belief in Est, but that has nothing to do with Philip and Elizabeth yet. And Philip and Elizabeth will eventually come to realize, I think, that even though they don't share his specific beliefs, Pastor Groovy Hair is not a bad guy. He's not a hypocrite. He really is doing good with Paige's money, and he also shares a lot of what are, at least officially, communist values. And they will eventually be able to use her membership in his Pinko church to recruit her to their cause. But for now, it really is wild how much the viewer just falls into empathy with the Jenningses, such that when we arrive at that final scene, you're kind of like, well, yeah, here's another problem that Philip's going to have to murder his way out of. And then Pastor Groovy Hair is just kind of amused by the absurdity of Philip's whole manner and is like, are you really going to beat me up over $600? Like, he's in a different show. Like, he doesn't realize the show he's in, because he doesn't. And, you know, like Stan, you know, the pastor and Stan are the kind of normie audience stand-ins. So yeah, I love this episode. It captures so much of what is great about the show and delivers all of that in such an economic way. So thank you. Great presentation.
Yeah, probably best not to end, with me, cause I don't like this show. This is a minority opinion. I'm not looking to convince anyone or be convinced, so don't at me. But I've always thought that this show, which I've like watched a fair bit of thanks to this podcast, was less than the sum of the parts. But I will say, like, this Matthew Reese's acting is just stunning in this episode. Like, it almost wins me over. And Carrie Russell, for whatever reason, in this role, and I understand that we're not necessarily supposed to like feel bonded and snuggly with her, and this is probably my issue and not an issue with the show or her performance, but there's just something about it that I have found terminally off-putting from the get. Like, I quit after 3 episodes because she was just so, I don't know. Like, brittle is not the right word, because this character is not brittle, but even she in this episode has this moment where Philip is really struggling with everything that he's been, you know, all the problems he's murdered his way out of, and he's kind of like, well, you know, it's different for you, and she's like, do you think it's easy for me? And I think the viewer is meant to understand that it is actually a little easier for her, if not a lot easier, but then everything that's passing between them in that moment, plus you also have that like meta-ness of their real life relationship that I always thought was interesting, frequently more interesting than for me than what was happening on the screen. Like, I should like this show, It's processy. It's a period piece. It has actors I really like.
It is weird that you don't.
I just can't. And it keeps coming up for the canon, or we do a season finale or a season premiere on the podcast. And I'm just like, why don't I want you? Like, just the dead drops alone. This should be Buntnip. It just isn't. But that scene in the church is really something. Like, that they're talking to each other, but also unlike parallel planes that don't intersect at all. So, I mean, it was an interesting episode, but this show is not for me, and I'm not sure how I'm going to vote. Great presentation, though, Alan. Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
Why is the transfer or the transcoding of the Americans on Amazon Prime so dark and grainy?
Yes,
it looks
thank you.
Terrible.
It looked like that when it was live. That's how dark the show was.
I couldn't tell what the fuck was going on until like 10 minutes in.
Yeah, the opening sequence at the training base, it feels like one of those 70s movies where they didn't have enough lights to light up a night scene properly for the viewer.
Yeah, it's like the parallax view, but like someone spilled ink on it.
Yep. Anyways, so
I always watched on screeners, so maybe screeners were also always super dark. I don't know.
Well, yeah, we'll get into it, but yeah, those are usually kind of crappy. Anyways, boo to Amazon Prime for what I believe is shitty transcoding. Item number two, not about this particular episode also, but it always bums me out when a TV show takes such care with his opening credits as the Americans did a very good job with their crazy collage of Cold War juxtapositions and fonts and this and that. And then they go into the actual episode and they're using fucking Georgia Bowl as their font for directed by and co-starring and all that kind of stuff. Like, have some pride of ownership. Use either the same font from your opening credits or find a more suitable font. You know, something a little more blocky would be in order for something called The Americans. Ditto the end credits. Like, just let's go to it. Let's get these people talking. Let's get those opening credits people talking to the byline people, and let's make that match happen. Cough. All right. There's a bunch of things I really enjoyed about this episode beyond what Alan and Tara were talking about, and I agree with what they were saying there with the themes and the structure of this episode. I really love referring to youth church as Teenage Sunday, and as I wish I would have reason to bring that up in my life, because Teenage Sunday sounds amazing. Like, that should be a band name or something like that for, you know, like Amy Grant's band in high school was called Teenage Sunday. I was unfamiliar with the concept of a youth Bible. What actually is a youth Bible? Is it just like, has it got groovy illustrations in it or something? So curiosity got the best of me, and I looked it up and I found a couple. So I want to read you from Genesis 1:6 to 1:8. And then God said, "Let there be a dome in the middle of the waters to separate one body of water from the other." God made the dome from the water above the dome. And so it happened. God called the dome sky. Like, I know they're taking a lot of liberties, but you know what we got here, guys?
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber.
Divine Domer. Domer.
Listen to it.
Domer?
I award you no points. And may God have mercy on your soul.
Perfect.
As always with all the episodes where Philip goes in disguise as sort of a late 70s to 80s look with the mustache and the ponytail, I just laugh out loud. Like, how is this? I know we're just dealing with, you know, cheap sable and spirit gum, but at a certain point, Philip's got to look in the mirror and say, I got to up my game. Somebody's gonna ID me, because this is bad. I stick out like a sore thumb. It's a really bad wig. It's a really bad mustache. It bothers me in the story of The Americans, but I love it in The Americans, the FX show. In that scene where we see him in the ponytail, he's on a short side.
Boardwalk or something.
Yeah, boardwalk by the beach. Is there anything more depressing than a boardwalk beach, A? and then in winter.
Yeah.
Ugh, I don't understand people that...
It's a very George Costanza kind of moment right there.
Uh-huh.
Really is.
Yeah. There's
just something utterly depressing about that. Like, I remember we got invited to a Jersey beach once. It was like October, November. I'm like, no.
Yeah.
No thanks. Hard pass. Kitchen duty as punishment for all her church stuff. Super effective. Boy, I don't know if I would do that again, having to mop the floor at 3 o'clock in the morning. Speaking about super effective, Clark and Martha in the Martha tape, super evil, but super effective.
Yeah.
Boy, that was a hard one. I always forget about Martha.
Poor Martha.
She's a character that I was super interested in throughout The Americans. As soon as she's off screen, my brain wants to just forget about her because it is like so sad. Her story is like,
yeah,
the most pathetic
mm-hmm.
thing in The Americans is Martha's story.
Yes.
And it just bums me out every time I think about her. So tomorrow, Martha will not be in my brain. There's nothing I can do about it. My brain is just going to expunge her.
Yeah.
But yeah, everything that you guys said about what makes this great, is how further, I believe it's further on, but how further on in the show do we get until Phillip's doing his new age self-help crap?
Oh, like season 5. It's much later. Maybe season 4.
I feel like there's like echoes between there about what he's like discovering a hole in himself now and what he's trying to fill later. You know, the seeds are here in this episode for sure.
Right.
But great episode. I also don't understand how this doesn't click with Sarah. I think it might be Felicity's short hair, to be honest with you. It just might be that, just that alone. She just needs that long hair.
If she had her natural curls.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so let's put this to the official vote. Tara Ariano, what say you?
I vote yay.
Sarah D. Bunting?
Yay for the acting, but episode overall is a nay from me. Sorry.
All right, but I'm going to say yay, so that means... That, The Americans, Season 2, Episode 9, Marshall Eagle, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and the loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I do. It is Peacock, finally being the first streaming service to get original Law & Order. It also has a launch date, July 15th, and a price, $5 a month with ads, $10 without. So that is finally happening. Mazel tov, everyone.
What's the value proposition for you, Sarah, for Peacock, Law & Order? Like, is that worth it?
No.
To be able to watch it on demand, or is Law & Order the kind of show that you just want to happen in your life and is on TV? Like, there's some shows...
Well, she has the DVDs.
Yeah. I know, but do you watch them regularly on
no,
DVD, or do
because,
you sort of
like... it's a... Now we're all so lazy that, like, to get up and change a DVD is like, no. Where's Mr. Butler trying to do that for me? Also, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not sure what happens to... The other franchises, like I'm not a purist. So the other franchises that sort of are on the channel or we or My Nine at lunchtime, that's fine. So I'm content to have it happen, but I'm also not getting rid of my DVDs because I don't. I feel like this changes us as a culture somehow, and I don't think in a good way.
Well, DVDs
and Peacock's not even going to have all the episodes. They're going to have like a selection of Law & Order Mothership. They're going to have all of some of the others, but I think Criminal Intent and Mothership, they're only going to have like highlights.
Come on. See,
it's bullshit.
That's like when you go to the truck stop and they got those VHS sets. It's like the best of Chuck Norris. And it's like Missing in Action 2 and Code of Silence. Like what?
Right. Yeah. But there already isn't like, I don't think there's any one channel that shows all of the whole run of the series. Like Sundance, for example, only has a certain number of seasons, and then TNT has different ones. Like it's, ugh.
I think we has them all and is showing and is like
really?
Slowly showing them in order because there's some dogs. Like we're slowly laboring through the Annie Paris era right now. Like apparently they have them all. That some of them it's like Sunza, really? Like you can keep those. Sorry.
The problem with Peacock is that Comcast doesn't have their heart into actually making like a true streaming service, a smash hit like a la Netflix or Hulu or mm-hmm. even Disney Plus. Like they're obviously hedging their bets to try to keep traditional TV going, and this is just sort of like picking up the scraps for people. Yeah. Like, this isn't a wholehearted investment into, like, if it was, you would see all of Law and Order on there. You would see, like, right, a lot more money being spent.
Well, they also announced a slate of, like, original shows that they're going to be doing too. But, like, at the same time, well, we'll get to it.
Okay. So, Loser League.
So it was, I mentioned it was TCA Press Tour, the last 2/500 weeks last forever. So we have a whole roundup of dead shows. Confederate, the
God.
Dead again?
Yeah, officially announced dead at HBO. That was the, yeah. So Cinemax apparently getting out of the original series business, which is weird because they were in it for a while. They had Banshee and whatever the fuck else. But anyway, Warrior. So, Warrior, future TBD, Jet, that show we watched one of. I guess that's not coming back either. Cinemax was always a question mark, though, to me, because, again, how do you get it? Like, there's a Max Go service, but it's only on computers. HBO Go, it does not carry Cinemax shows.
I wonder if they're... scripted efforts are going to be sort of not necessarily show by show, but the resources are going to be put into HBO Max.
I'm sure
they are.
Yeah.
And like Warrior was already announced that they were making a second season. So I'm sure a lot of those are going to get sucked up into HBO Max. However, that'll work. Mindhunter, all but dead at Netflix. Mm-hmm. They say because David Fincher is too busy, but all of the actors have been released from their contracts.
Mm. Oh, that means Stay Frosty could happen. Anna Torv.
Sure. Netflix, it was already announced, of course, that Grace and Frankie was ending, but Marta Kaufman, who created it, put the platform on blast by saying it was not her choice to end it when it's ending, and was not the first to say that. Raphael Bob Waksberg, who is the creator of BoJack Horseman, said the same thing recently, so now the creators are coming out and being like, well, fuck you then. Which, you know what, if you got the juice, might as well do it. Back to HBO, Damon Lindelof has said he has no interest in making more Watchmen, and so Casey Bloys is like playing games about whether they're going to do it without him, which don't. Watchmen is done. Please don't make more. Also getting out of the scripted series.
I don't believe it's done.
It should be.
Well, yeah, but...
it probably should be, but I suspect like in a year... they're going to announce that, like, Lindelof has handpicked a successor who has a new take on it, who's going to do something else, and he'll give
Jerk
his approval,
motion.
And HBO will have created enough distance, and they'll do it that way.
I mean, you're probably right, but I hate that that's the world we live in. Also, getting out of the scripted space, Facebook Watch, a platform where you could watch scripted shows.
Oh, Facebook Watch. Okay, I thought you said Facebook.
No, no. They had shows including Sorry for Your Loss and Limetown, both dead at Facebook Watch as they decide to focus on unscripted shows.
I don't understand why. Like
why they tried? Because everyone tried. That's
the whole thing. I know, but come on. Like YouTube, Facebook, Twitter with their NFL deal. Like just... know what you are and figure out your strengths there and build on that. Like, it's exhausting. Mm-hmm. It's exhausting. It's like when everybody tried to be a social media company 3 years ago when it just wouldn't fit. Like, here's a site that's got some traffic, but now it's like kind of like a dating site too. Like,
right.
Nope.
Right. Finally, Hulu is not making any more Veronica Mars, which is a drag because I thought that last season was very good.
Contracts aside, they'll be able to sell that somewhere else if they want to, I bet.
Perhaps.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that won't happen.
Yeah, it's not a big eyeball show, I bet, like because I bet they have like a dedicated but relatively small audience, but it's buzzy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know who else seems to be throwing money at everything? Quibi. Take it across the street to Quibi. Quibi's buying every pitch.
Speaking about buying every pitch, do you know what time it is?
Is it game time?
It's game time, folks. I should have mentioned this up top, but I just want to say this is our first recording in our new podcast studio, he says in air quotes, in our extra room. I finally got it up to snuff. It's 90% ready. So if it sounds a little bit different, hopefully everything's going well with the recording, you know, first time. So if you stuck with it for 1 hour and 7 minutes, you're like, this is the worst sounding podcast I've ever heard. I fucked something up, but hopefully it sounds better. This is the eighth game time of this season. The scores are Sarah 3, value guest 2, Tara 1. That equals 6. It's going to be 7. No, because nobody won last week.
All right.
Except me. I guess me. I gave myself the point, didn't I? So yes. Tara 1, Dave 1. Today we are playing Slash Fiction from David Ellis Dickerson, friend of the show, who earns himself an extra credit topic of his choosing. Today's game is a hard PG-13, maybe even a soft R, so toss your kids in the trunk if you're in the car listening.
Nice.
I'm going to read little pieces of Slash Fiction, and you're going to tell me what show is being written about.
Oh, wow. No.
How many of these are supernatural?
I know. I was just thinking that. I
cannot divulge that information, but I do need a steel meal situation, please.
Thank you, Dave. I have one steel meal plus one extravaganza gong, and that is it. Sarah exhausted hers, and of course we all know the valued guests got Reinwald Jones.
Got
2 weeks
Reinwald
ago.
Jones.
All right, so let's throw to Piggy to see our playing order today.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, our order today is Sarah, Alan, then Tara. Are we ready to play Slash Fiction?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, this is Part 1, quotes. These are all fictional. Quotes from works of naughty fan fiction. Identify the show from the quote. For example, if I said, Sydney collapsed breathless on her pillow and said, okay, that is my favorite Rambaldi device. You would say the show is
Alias.
And you would get 1 point. And that's how we play.
Okay.
First question to Sarah. Michael, he said testily, you put it in the wrong exhaust pipe.
Oh. Knight Rider? Oh.
Oh, my God.
Alan. She pressed up against him until they were nose to snout. So you're telling me, she said, that being green is hard?
The Muppet Show?
Muppet Show is correct. Tara, your first question. Now that's what I call some big giant head.
Oh, no. What show has the big giant head? Shit. Oh. Is it Doctor Who?
Nobody's got steel mills, but if anybody knows the answer to this one, please shout it out.
I don't.
Nobody? That was Third Rock from the
Sun.
Yep.
Back to Sarah. I know it's different, but close your eyes and pretend I'm Bo, he said coyly.
Coily.
Oh.
Is it the Dukes of Hazzard?
That's pretty good.
Alan.
Who hurt you, Dave Dickerson?
Yep.
Captain, I cannot hold it any longer. She's going to blow.
Oh.
Star Trek.
You hope so.
Tara. I'm so sorry, Rosie. I thought that was your vacuum attachment.
The Jetsons.
Back to Sarah D. Bunting. Iris sighed patiently. Once again, Barry, that was over way too fast.
Barry?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's your answer, Barry? No. Barry, the Flash, over way too fast. The Flash does everything fast, you see.
Yeah, got it.
Including sex. Alan.
Yep.
Keep going, Gunn, said Wesley. I'm a watcher.
Angel.
Tara. This won't work, boss, said Natalie. Every time we have sex, you spend 3 hours cleaning the gimp suit.
I don't think this is right, but I'm going to say it anyway. Sports night.
That's what I would have guessed.
That's funny that Sarah would have guessed this, because if anybody was going to get this on the panel, I think it would be Sarah, because she watched Monk.
Oh! Even though there was a Natalie on Monk.
There was.
All right, this is back to Sarah. You couldn't handle me, Wilbur.
Oh my God.
Look, Slash Fiction goes...
It goes places.
A lot of categories.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Wilbur?
I don't know. Charlotte's Web, the TV show? I'm going to be mad.
All right. I'm going to buzz you on that one. They're going to read it in character. See if you get it. Oh, you couldn't handle me, Wilbur.
Alan knows.
Alan, what
I don't know.
It?
A horse is a horse, and he's hung like a horse if his name is Mr. Ed.
Oh, gross.
Mr. Ed. Yes. All right, Alan, here's your actual questions. 4 points.
Oh, boy.
It's not lupus. It's chlamydia.
House.
Yeah.
All right, Tara.
No. Yep.
Ouch. No wonder you call it Mr. Pointy.
Oh, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Everybody's last question, round one, coming at you, and then we'll take a score break. Sarah D. Bunting. Let's do this, she said, removing her glasses. But remember, my safe word is jinkies. Let's do this, she said, removing her glasses. But remember, my safe word is jinkies.
I'm going to be mad, but I don't know. Benson?
Yeah, you are going to be. You are going to be mad. Anybody?
Yep.
Scooby-Doo.
Scooby-Doo.
Oh, correct. Yep. Mad.
Velma. Alan?
Yep.
It's okay if you can't shapeshift anymore. We'll just set this phaser on vibrate.
Deep Space Nine?
Deep Space Nine, correct. Rest in peace, Odo.
R.I.P.
Last question of round one for Tara Ariano.
Yes.
Just one more question, ma'am. If the lights went out at 7:42, how could you have seen the color of the victim's butt plug?
Columbo. Dirty Columbo.
Dirty Columbo, ma'am. All right. Let's hear the scores, please, Tara.
All right. Alan is in the lead with a perfect score of 5 points. I have three. Yeah, Alan is the biggest sicko.
Yep.
I have three. Sarah has two.
All right, Sarah. That
Sarah's means the only one of us going to heaven.
You are. In the Grossworth / fiction reprieve zone.
Yay!
Answer three of these Trivial Pursuit TV box questions correctly. I will give you 2 points. Manage to sweep them all. 4 points. Are you ready?
Good luck there.
I am.
Thank you.
Classics. Whose short-lived 1963 musical variety series had such guests as Ray Bolger, Liza Minnelli, and Mickey Rooney? You know, Ray Bolger looks out for one guy.
Ray Bolger.
Oh, well. Ray Bolger.
Oh, the Ray Bolger one. Judy Garland?
Correct. Hey!
Yeah!
Well done. Sitcoms. What sitcoms theme song is admirably performed by Eddie Albert and Eva Gabor?
Admirably performed.
Eddie Albert. Eva Gabor.
Beverly Hillbillies?
Incorrect.
Close.
Green Acres is a place you
right. Fucking pig.
Drama. What seemingly inept cop unnerved crooks by often saying just one more question? By saying just one more question. What color was his butt plug? Is the full quote.
Neon green.
We're going to give you that for Columbo. All right, kids and games. You need one more. You got three more categories. What two biblical characters did Hanna-Barbera base a cartoon series on?
Cain and Abel?
Incorrect. The answer was Samson and Goliath.
Oh, Samson and Goliath?
Yep.
Thought it was David and Goliath.
I don't think that's Hanna-Barbera. Oh. You're thinking of the Claymation thing?
Yeah,
that's different. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, still have two categories. You only need one of these right. Stars. What weatherman admitted my plan was to fill the void left by J. Fred Muggs?
And he did.
Willard Scott?
Willard Scott
she
is correct.
It.
Yeah!
Let's do this last question because I think you're going to get it too, just for bragging rights. What was the first series to spin off from Alice?
From Alice?
From Alice, yeah.
Oh, shit. I don't know.
Oh.
Sorry.
It was Flo.
Flo.
Oh.
But that doesn't matter. You don't need it. So you got your 2 points. Let's hear the updated scores, please.
All right. I'm still in last place with 3 points. Sarah now has 4 points. Alan still has 5.
Close game.
Very
we
close
have
game.
15 questions left here in part two. Part right. two is our crossovers section.
Oh, no.
Fan
no. fiction often indulges in crossovers. So the answers to the next 15 questions are all clues to two shows. 1 point each for the show. So okay. Maximum 2 points for each.
Got it.
Note that Got some it. TV shows repeat from the previous round because slash fiction.
Sure.
The first six questions are all story titles.
Okay.
You have to identify the two shows being crossed over. We're starting with Sarah D. Bunting. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Big Pussy in Wee Britain.
The first show is The Sopranos.
There's one.
And the second part was what? Wee Britain?
Wee Britain, yeah.
Wee Britain. I have no idea what that is. Gilmore Girls.
Yeah, W-E. Yeah. Sopranos and Arrested Development.
Oh, right. Okay.
Oh, God. Alan?
Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
A.K.A. Danny Rand puts his whole hand in there.
Well, unfortunately, that would be Jessica Jones, and the whole hand going in there would be the Iron Fist.
You are correct for 2 points. Oh. Yikes. Tara?
Wow. Yeah.
The one where Fry delivers a series of pizzas with extra sausage.
Okay. Futurama and Friends.
2 points. Back to Sarah. I like where Picky is going here. The tiki idol in the hoo-ha.
The tiki idol in the hoo-ha. All right. Brady Bunch.
That's good for one.
And hoo-ha? Dr. Ruth. I'm going to be mad, but I don't know the second one.
Anybody? Hoo-ha?
That's Golden Girls?
Bones. Something from Bones.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh.
To Mr. Seppenwall. The G-spot hypothesis, an introduction to clitoral anatomy.
All right, so one of these is the Big Bang Theory. And the other one would be Community.
Yes, well done.
Gross.
All right, here's our last title question for Tara.
Uh-huh.
Oh, God. It's a beautiful day to be pegged in the tropics, or Ginger Rogers Fred.
That would be Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Let's just take a moment to appreciate Ginger Rogers
That's
Fred.
That's very good.
That's great.
Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and Gilligan's Island.
Oh, my God.
All right, that's the end of part one of section one of part two. Okay. Let's hear the scores, please.
All right. Alan still easily in the lead with 9 points. Uh-huh. I have 7. Sarah has 6.
All right, Sarah, you're in it again. The Grocer's Equalizer Challenge Zone returns.
Mont Dynasty.
For a possible 4 points this time, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, 4 and 8 points.
Right.
Yeah, depending on how many answers. So big points ahead of you.
Collector!
Good luck. This will be our last Equalizer Challenge Zone of the game, so make it count. First category is classics. What TV hero fired 12,684 silver bullets during his long career? What TV hero?
The Lone Ranger.
Sitcoms. What's Mike Stivic studying in college in All in the Family? What's his major?
I don't know. Business.
Business? No.
I don't know.
Sociology.
Oh, okay. I would have said political science.
Yeah. Drama. What Western starred Barbara Stanwyck as Victoria Barkley? A lot of Stanwyck questions lately. Should look up who that is. I have no idea.
Yeah, Trivial Pursuit loves her and Hitler and Mount Kilimanjaro. What Western starred her?
Yeah.
Oh, God, there were so many. I don't know. Gunsmoke.
The Big Valley.
Never heard of it.
3 questions to get 2 correct. What Groucho Marx sidekick hosted the shows Anybody Can Play and Your Surprise Package? Well, your surprise package is a real show. I didn't make that up for this episode.
Well, Harpo didn't talk. So Chico Marx?
George Fenneman.
Okay,
sure.
All right, Precious, I need both of these stars. Which of Charlie's Angels left after the 76-77 season to race cars in Europe? So I assume this is the actor.
Yeah. Well, who knows?
No, it's the character.
Oh, is it the character? The character left to race cars in Europe? Okay, all right.
We'll
let you answer twice on this one, because I may have misled you there, so...
She said Farrah Fawcett Majors.
Okay, Farrah Fawcett is incorrect. Give me one more.
One more answer? I don't know. Jacqueline Smith?
The answer was Jill Monroe. Jill Monroe.
That's Farrah Fawcett Majors.
There you go.
Oh, that's the character?
Yeah.
Oh.
So I'm going to give you that one, Tara.
Yeah.
Sarah.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
Nobody knows her name is Jill Monroe. Am I wrong?
Well, I didn't understand what the question was asking, character or actor, because usually the answer is usually a celebrity.
Yeah.
Real person. So it was confusing.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. So you need this one. What Carol O'Connor series is made in Covington, Georgia?
In the Heat of the Night.
She did it!
There it is.
Yep. All right. So let's hear the updated scores. Please start.
Fucking hell. Everything has changed. I still have 7 points. Nothing's changed for me. Alan has 9 points. Sarah has 10.
And the surprise package. You're going to hell.
All right. This is the second part of part two. These are quotes just like before, but they are referencing two shows. So 2 points per quote.
Got it.
Sarah D. Bunting, you're up.
Yeah.
This is by request, in brackets, from Dave. Do the voice.
Oh, no.
If we're both dead live, then it doesn't count as necrophilia, at least not in Seattle. Blah. I'll read that normally for you. If we're both dead live, then it doesn't count as necrophilia, at least not in Seattle. Blah.
Blah. That was art. Dracula and iZombie.
That is good for two. Alan.
Yep.
Miss Hollowell, we can't stop time, but my coworkers can fuck you in slow motion on the beach.
All right. So one of those is Baywatch. Hollowell and stopping time.
Yeah, Miss Hollowell, we can't stop time, but my coworkers and I can something something slow motion on the beach.
The only show I can think of where someone could stop time was Out of This World.
I love that answer.
Anybody?
Charmed.
Charmed, yeah. The Hollowell.
Ah.
Yeah. Tara Ariano.
Yep.
On Earth, we definitely didn't call this fracking, said Eleanor, and continued forking.
The Good Place and Battlestar Galactica.
You are correct for two. Back to Sarah. Oscar, he said, grabbing a sponge. I believe those were two men dressed as women.
The Odd Couple and Bosom Buddies?
Correct.
Yep.
Nicely done. Alan.
Yep.
Well, Mr. Greyjoy, she said, if you want to become a porn star here in New York City, I can see one major obstacle.
Keeping it all in the HBO family with Game of Thrones and the Deuce.
That is good for two.
Good.
Oh, boy. All right, Tara.
Yes.
What are you thinking, Kit? He said, storming into the garage. Don't you know that 1928 Porter has a son who's my age?
Okay, Knight Rider. Downton Abbey? Is it Boardwalk Empire?
No. Anybody?
Timeless?
Oh.
I mean, we're all too young. My Mother, the Car.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Everybody's got one question left, so can I please get the score started?
You can. I have 10 points. Alan has 12 points. Sarah D. Bunting has locked it up with 14 points.
Well, oh, no, wow. I could force a tie here.
Oh, that's
no.
true.
Yeah.
Alan could.
There's a mathematical tie in play.
That's true.
Yeah.
True, true.
So.
Good luck, everybody, except me.
Sarah, you only need to get one of these two parts to get your points, and I'm feeling pretty good about your chances. Here we go.
Okay.
More voice work for Dave. You like it rough, he said, to see how the Canadian-German Shepherd would react. Jesus.
Wow.
You like it rough, he said, to see how the Canadian-German Shepherd would react. I mean, at least we're keeping it in species here.
This is disgusting. And I believe also concerns Scooby-Doo. and The Littlest Hobo.
That is good for 2 points. All right. All right, Alan, this is a good one. That was definitely sponge-worthy, she said. Next time, let's invite your squid friend.
Oh.
Seinfeld and SpongeBob SquarePants.
You are correct, and good for 2. Oh, our last question for Tara. Are you sure you're not from St. Olaf, Minnesota? Rose asked, getting into the woman's bed. No, said her lookalike, moving closer. Ohio.
Okay, Golden Girls. And Mary Tyler Moore, I guess. Fuck. Hot and Cleveland.
Hot and Cleveland was the answer we were looking for. You're on the right track with 2 Betty Whites.
Leave it to Betty White to screw Tara over.
Final scores, please, Tara.
I finished with 11. Alan finished with 14. Sarah is our victor with 16.
Congratulations, Sarah.
Thank you.
Sarah.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We took a trip down to Little America before going around the dial with stops at 911 Lone Star, Sex Education, and Awkwafina is Nora from Queens. Alan put on a terrible wig and mustache and applied his tradecraft to get Marshall Eagle from the Americans into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was the winner of this week's Sensual Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
Sorry, Sam and Dean.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Wow, great sprinkler system.
And Alan Sepinwall.
You respect Jesus, but not us!
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Jesus, it smells worse than the shit it covers up.
Yeah, have a good night. You too.